Had this bushy hair.
This meeting of the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee will come to order. We have the oral health practitioner issue up before us today, and we're going to start out with a brief, I'm thinking 3 to 4 minute presentation from the Department of Health on the oral health practitioner work group study. Mark, show me. Oh, thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. And I will try and take seriously your time request. Just to get things started off here. As I think all of you know, last year's legislature assigned MDH to lead the work group you created to develop recommendations to implement your 2008 oral health practitioner legislation. We did that, and we believe we did that well, and we want to thank you for that opportunity. The work group you created met 8 times between August and December and produced recommendations and draft legislation. 13 stakeholders from groups you identified in last year's law participated and participated actively. Staff supported their work with background research. The group also contributed their own expertise, including that of Minsky and the University of Minnesota. Public input was also collected and shared. Many of their decisions were made by consensus. Some were made by majority vote. Of those votes, some were close and some were not. The recommendations and all the deliberations are completely and extensively documented in this 117-page report, which I believe many of you have seen. The recommendations cover some major areas: requirements to practice in underserved areas, educational requirements and testing, licensure and regulatory requirements, scope of practice and level of supervision, the economic impact of oral health practitioners, and evaluation of the effects of oral health practitioners. Under scope and supervision, 54 procedures were approved by the work group, 40 of them by at least 10 of the 13 members. Most other votes were 8-5, as were most of the votes to allow general supervision. At the end of last session, when we got this assignment, we at MDH were told to expect that all decisions would end up being made by 7-6 votes. So we were pleased to find that there was more agreement than had been expected. In summary, the department led the work group through what we believe was a valid process. That process produced a valid set of recommendations that we believe provides you a solid foundation for further action by the legislature.
Thank you, very. That was concise. Senator Prettner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Schoenbaum, on those votes, there were 8-5. Were there 5 dentists on the committee?
I think there were, so I'm getting help here, 7 dentists on the committee.
And were the 5 that were dissenting generally the dentists?
Yes, but not exclusively.
Okay,
Mr. Chair,
you.
And Senator Prettner-Solon.
So, Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Schoenbaum, just as a matter of clarification, the work group was designated, as was provided in the statute, and the majority of the members on the work group were dentists.
Further questions for Mr. Schoenbaum? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If now, Senator Lynch, if you want to present Senate File 1106. And while she's going up there, I will mention for the committee and so on, what we're going to be doing is I'll be encouraging committee members only to ask clarification questions, not to have our debate until there have been both presentations. But again, you're welcome to ask questions anytime. I'll just encourage people to focus on it because we're going to have Senator Lynch present her bill and have the witnesses afterwards. And then Senator Prettner-Solon is going to present the language. She wants the dental therapist licensure and practice limitations, and then she's going to have her witnesses, and then at that time I'd like us to have the committee discussion and debate. But again, people are welcome to go as they wish. And we're going to ask all witnesses, if you see the list, there's a long list of people on both sides, so please try and be concise. Thank you. Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm here today with Senate File 1106. Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill in the forum for discussion today.
And Senator Lynch, while it's being distributed, you want to just briefly begin?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First, to begin with, I would, as Mr. Schoenbaum reflected, this is the next phase of our journey, and I wish to at this time thank my co-authors who've been with me along the way, Senator Berglund, Senator Lori, and Senator Marty. I am really proud to be sitting before you today because Minnesota has a chance to truly lead the nation in its desire to improve access and its desire to address some of the root causes that plague the oral health crisis in Minnesota and in this country. I'm really honored to be here today to provide you with some expert testimony from across the world. And as we move through the discussion today, as I have done each step along the way with each committee that we have been before, and as we did in the work group, we were able to get here today, I think, because if we can all pause for a moment and keep our focus on the need that's before us, I think that that'll be really helpful. I probably don't need to remind the committee, I probably don't need to remind the people in this room today that the legislation before us today is no more for the Dental Hygiene Association than it is for the dentist, than it is for our higher ed institutions. The legislation that's before us today is for all of those voices that so often are not in these halls, those voices that are not in this room. The legislation that's before us today can serve as a reminder and as some hope and our desire that never again in the United States will another child die because of an oral health problem that was left untreated. So with that, Mr. Chair, I have with me to begin with Michael Scandrett, who's going to help us walk through and explain some of the portions of Senate File 1106.
Welcome to the committee,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm with the Minnesota Safety Net Coalition, which represents the state's health care providers and organizations who serve a predominantly low-income, uninsured, and disadvantaged Minnesotans. And the Safety Net Coalition took an interest in this issue about 2 years ago when all of our members, including hospitals, mental health centers, community clinics, and the community dental clinics, all were beginning to see lack of access to dental care as one of their top issues for their members. And even, for example, the Minnesota Association of the Community Mental Health Centers did a survey of the people they serve and found that inability to get treatment for dental problems showed up as one of the top issues for their members. So they are all strongly in support of us moving forward. What I'm going to do first is just go quickly through the bill and then make a few comments on the bill from the Safety Net Coalition's perspective. And even though there's a lot of pages to the bill, a lot of this is technical language that simply inserts oral health practitioner in all the different places where healthcare professions are regulated. So I just want to hit some of the key points. First, on the first page, obviously a definition of oral health practitioner. But at the bottom of page one in section two, just to be clear, this requires the oral health practitioner to work under the supervision of a Minnesota licensed dentist. And secondly, that it's limited to practicing in settings that serve low-income, uninsured, and underserved patients, or in communities that have a shortage of dental professionals. I'm going to skip through some of the next sections because they're primarily technical, but if we move to page 3, section 4, this lists some additional requirements, including that the oral health practitioner, after they graduate from approved school, would need to pass a comprehensive competency clinical exam to show that they're capable of doing the services. There's a big section, section 5, resident dental providers, which was a section that was requested from the Board of Dentistry, making sure that there's an opportunity for students who are in programs to do clinical services without doing the unauthorized practice of dentistry. It's primarily a technical section. Then we can skip through a number of pages that are technical changes as well as various fees that will be required for licensure. And then we get to page 10, which is section 19. And this allows the oral health practitioner to supervise up to 3 dental assistants to work with them in their practice and the practice of the supervising dentist. Then I'm going to skip forward to page 11, section 22. And this is the main part of the bill listing the requirements for oral health practitioner. It restates again that this must be a practice under supervision of a Minnesota licensed dentist, and they must have a written agreement with the supervising dentist that determines the scope of practice that's permitted by the dentist. And the supervising dentist can limit the types of things that the oral health practitioner can do below that would be authorized by the law if they choose to do that. And there are some additional requirements in the bill around the collaborative management agreement. I want to point out on page 12, 24, the collaborating dentist must be licensed and practicing in Minnesota. To point out, it's not just that they're licensed, but they also have to be practicing in Minnesota, so it couldn't be remote supervision by a dentist that isn't present in the state. Later on page 12 requires that the practitioner must have professional liability coverage and, again, has to have a collaborative management agreement documented. And then also, because of some issues that were raised by the Minnesota Dental Association wanting to address some potential problems, is to require that on the top of page 13 that the supervising dentist has to accept patients by referral anytime the OHP counters problems that require a dentist, and also to require periodic reviews of the competency and practice of the oral health practitioner by the supervising dentist. The next part of the bill on page 13 is the long list of items in the proposed scope of practice for the oral health practitioner. And I want to point out that on the oral health practitioner work group, there was not a lot of disagreement about the scope of practice. The disagreement was about whether there needed to be a dentist on site when some of those procedures are provided. So we've kind of narrowed the issues significantly. On page 14, the bottom of the page, is the authority for the oral health practitioner to have limited prescribing authority, non-narcotic drugs in certain categories that are identified in the bill. There's some, again, more technical sections, but on page 15, the second half of the page is the language that limits the practice of OHPs to certain settings where there is a shortage or lack of dentists available to practice. This bill is focused where there aren't dentists available to serve people, and that can be a variety of safety net settings that are listed here, but it also could be a rural community that's been designated as a health professional shortage area. At the request of the Minnesota Dental Association, there was also added something that would allow a private dentist's office to hire an OHP as long as that practitioner, that practice, serves at least 50% people who meet the categories of low income, underserved, uninsured, and so forth. So that's the exception to the rule that a private dentist's office cannot hire an oral health practitioner. I think that the remaining sections of the bill are primarily technical. At the end of the bill, just to point out, on page 19 of the bill, there is a requirement for an evaluation of the program, so it will be closely monitored after the first students graduate and begin practice to check on the quality of care and the impact on access and the costs of the program. So that's the explanation of the bill, and I just would like to make a few comments on behalf of the Safety Net Coalition. And again, we have been working on this for several years, but there are others that we have worked together with that have been working on this concept for even longer than that. And our main research, as we've looked at what's driving the access problem, it does come down to a shortage of dentists who are either willing or available to serve certain populations. And these tend to be the populations that are very difficult to serve. So we can understand why, either economically or even from a practice perspective, it's really challenging to serve people. If they have a disability, if they're low income, they have no transportation, they have other barriers that increases the chance that they will not show up for an appointment or that their dental problems will be complicated by other challenges that they face. So in looking at that, then the Safety Net Coalition concluded that what we need is to find a type of oral health practitioner that is willing to practice in those settings, can be economically affordable in those settings, and is a combination of both a public health perspective to try to keep people's dental health as good as it can be, as well as their ability to provide basic dental procedures limited to basic and routine services. And we have a number of a Safety Net Coalition providers, dental clinics, and others who are prepared and anxious to hire oral health practitioners and are excited to look forward to that possibility. And some of those will be here to speak to you today. I have just a couple other comments that I wanted to make, and I want to point out that because we have limited time, the Safety Net Coalition did provide a rather lengthy written testimony. And because this is so complex and you're hearing from so many different people, we're really trying to capture all the issues in that document. So when you have time, I encourage you to read and learn about things that we're not going to have time to talk to you about today. A few things to point out is that the problem is not going to go away. It's going to continue to get worse. And one fact that would just help you understand that is that the average age of dentists in rural Minnesota is 59 years old, and that recent information from the Department of Health shows that a large number of current dentists have plans to retire in the near term. So we're just not going to have enough dentists, and that problem is going to get worse. At the same time, with the economy, we have more people that are be seeking dental care, especially through the safety net providers. So we're facing a real challenge coming ahead and our ability to stay current with that. I wanted to comment, too, on we have come a long way since last year. I wanted to point out some areas where there was agreement and is agreement with the people that have been working on this at the work group. One is there's no question that there's a serious problem with lack of access to dental care, so we probably don't have to argue too much about that issue. It's also agreement that a person with less than a dental degree can be trained to do a broad array of services safely and effectively. And the issues are whether the dentist needs to first examine and diagnose the patient and whether they need to be on site when the services are provided. Again, as I mentioned before, the long list of services that can be provided by this practitioner, there is not major disagreement there as well. It's not that they can't effectively provide the services. It's all about supervision and diagnosis and treatment. The remaining issue is the one of what educational institutions should be providing the training. And I think it's rather unusual around here to see the legislature dictating that. The normal approach is to define the competencies and the licensing requirements and to let educational institutions who are capable of training people to those competencies step forward. I want to comment on the accreditation issue as well, because that has come often, and we've been in touch with the Association of Dental Educators, Dental Schools, Dental Hygienists, Dental Assistants, and they have told us the usual procedure for accreditation when a new professional enters the system. They wait until the education programs are in place, that one or two classes of practitioners have graduated and are in practice before the accreditation agencies will begin to step in and accredit those. And there's a long history of other practitioners where that has occurred in the past. So we can't wait for accreditation because accreditation agencies will not step in and do that until there's somebody out there to accredit. I want to comment, too, that during the workgroup process, the majority, if not all, of the workgroup members were very interested in the other model that was proposed by the Minnesota Dental Association and the University of Minnesota. And, in fact, at the workgroup, we had hoped that we would be able to bring you a recommendation for both models and seeing it as two levels of licensure that would represent a career path for a variety of different types of people to enter the system and move through to the more advanced levels of practice. So we have no opposition to the other bill. We hope that the two bills could be reconciled and in some way brought forward because each addresses a different type of access problem. And for those clinics, such as the community clinics, that have some dentists on site but can't keep up with the demand, the idea of a dental therapist who can practice with them in the clinic can be helpful to extend their capacity and control their costs. But in those places where dentists aren't available to practice, that model doesn't help us. We need someone who's able to go out there, see the patient, provide preventive care, identify problems, provide some basic treatment to those people so that there's not a requirement either for return visits or to transport someone to a dental office, which often can be a long ways away. Final comment, just because you are all receiving various forms of information about this, maybe hanging on your doorknobs or handed out during the course of visits on the Hill. And I wish we didn't have to do this, but we do have to spend a certain amount of time just correcting the information that's been provided to you. And I just want to point out three areas that you may have heard. And if you're hearing about these areas or if dentists who are calling you are raising these, I want you to know that they're not correct. One is that the literature says that the oral health practitioner would go to a two-year college. No one has ever recommended a two-year college. What has been discussed is a master's degree that requires both a bachelor's degree and two additional years of graduate school. There is no proposal out there for a two-year college program, so that is not accurate. The second statement, and we've seen this often, is that they're practicing without supervision. We have never suggested, nor has any person who's been part of this suggested, that we are creating a practitioner who is not legally obligated to enter into a supervision agreement with a dentist, and that dentist is responsible for that oral health practitioner in supervising them, determining their competency, and making sure that they're providing quality care. And the final statement is that this has never been duplicated anywhere in the world, and we have before you today real evidence that it has been. And I'll just give the example of Canada, who has had a program for 35 years. Their dental therapists can treat both adults and children. They can do extractions. They can do fillings. They can practice in a variety of settings. Some are in the cities. Some are in rural communities. And over that long period of time, they have an unblemished record in terms of quality and care. One incident, which was a dentist from another country who came, became licensed as a dental therapist and began to practice beyond the dental therapist scope of practice, even though they had not obtained a dental license here. And every other case, no complaints, no disciplinary actions, no lawsuits or claims filed. They're all have liability insurance. I believe it costs about $250 a month. The insurers feel their, pardon? $205 a month to get liability insurance, and the underwriters did look at their program before they made any decisions about that. So just want to make sure we are working off the facts and understand what's being proposed here. So with that, turn it over to Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Chair.
Senator Lynch moves the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape she wants. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then we will move right along in our testimony. And at this time, I'd like to call forward Dr. Sue Hammersmith, Dr. Linda Baer, Marilyn Long.
While they're coming forward, Senator Torres-Rabe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Lynch, I would like to make a request with all due respect. We have 17 people, Mr. Chairman, who are here to testify to present their opinion, and I would like to know if it would be possible for us to kind of limit the presentation to new aspects so that we don't repeat what has been said, and then limit our time so that we can have an opportunity to have questions at the end, because 17 people, if we do about 2 minutes apiece, we had the first witness took about 20 minutes, so we would be here for a long time if we don't limit ourselves.
And Senator Torres-Ray, we're going to make sure we get the testimony from both sides done in time so we can have the discussion and vote. So I will encourage when somebody is speaking for the next person on the witness list to be ready to come forward to the table at that time. Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Dr. Baer.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Linda Baer, the Senior Vice Chancellor for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. With me today, President of Metropolitan State, Sue Hammersmith, and the Dean of Metropolitan State College of Nursing and Health Sciences, Marilyn Lohan. We are here to tell you about our innovative academic program that will prepare oral health practitioners to help address the chronic disparities in access to oral health care in Minnesota. Over many decades, Minnesotan state universities have adapted and expanded to add programs that meet state needs, from teacher education to nursing to dental hygiene to engineering and to high-tech programs to master's and now applied doctoral programs in nursing. Now we have added a master's of science program for oral health practitioners to address serious gaps in one part of our healthcare delivery system. This program is the result of more than 3 years of development work. We have drawn on the extensive study and planning work among dental professionals nationally. We have drawn together a program advisory committee of experienced dental and healthcare educators who have taken the professional competencies developed nationally and translated them into an outstanding Master's of Science curriculum. The program has been through extensive review and approval process at the university and at our system level. Every facet of the program is in place, from the admissions process through coursework and clinical training. After reviewing successful mid-level provider programs internationally, we find ample confirmation that the Minnesota State College University is an appropriate home for this kind of practitioner-focused program. From one country to another, in fact, 52 countries, there is a healthy variety of approaches where this mid-level practitioner, where they are trained based on local history, resources, and choices. Some of the dental therapists are trained in dental schools. Some are trained in freestanding dental therapist schools. Some are trained in university settings. The important fact is that these educational programs in varied settings all produce graduates who practice safely and effectively. You will hear discussion about accreditation. I can assure you that the Metropolitan State University is fully accredited by our regional accreditor, the Higher Learning Commission of the North Central Association. New programs are never accredited when they begin operations. Rather, accreditation review takes place after a program is operated long enough to produce graduates. The report of the Legislative Working Group provides for the Minnesota Board of Dentistry to oversee the program, not to accredit it, until a national accrediting body takes action. The board was represented on the working group throughout these deliberations about this temporary role in the case of a new program of a new type. Finally, the Minnesota State College Universities provide an outstanding long-term delivery system for the future preparation of oral health practitioners. Through our university campuses across the state, we will be able to prepare mid-career professionals near where they live and work so that they can continue to practice where the need is found. As always, we are ready to go to work to strengthen Minnesota and to make it work. Now, President Hammersmith will bring the university's perspective on the oral health practitioner program.
Thank you, Dr. Baer.
Mr. Chair and members, good afternoon. I'm Sue Hammersmith, and it's my privilege to serve as the president of Metropolitan State University. Metropolitan State University is the public comprehensive university charged to serve the 7-county Twin Cities region. Metropolitan State has a reputation in American higher education as an unusually innovative institution with a core commitment to broad access and to serving the public good through high-quality academic programs, including outstanding graduate health care training and education for working professionals. Our oral health practitioner program reflects established practice across the industrialized world. However, it is new to Minnesota. You will naturally ask, is this the right time and is this the right approach to move ahead to meet the unmet dental health care needs across Minnesota? I'd like to ask you to engage for a moment with me in a mental experiment. Suppose we were in the 1970s in Metropolitan State University, we're a new university, and we brought forward a proposal such as this to you. At that time, you would naturally have questions. Is this a proven model? Is it safe? Is it effective? And can it reach the underserved populations of the state? You might at that time have said, you know, we're just not comfortable passing this yet, but we would like you to run some pilots. Do some pilot programs, see if you can put together a curriculum that works, go out, research them, and 30 or 40 years from now, come back and bring us a model that, based on the pilots, is known to be effective. That is, in essence, what you have before you. This program has existed in one form or another in dozens of industrialized nations, and it has a proven track record of safety, effectiveness, and cost-effectiveness. We have incorporated into our program design the curriculum and the best practices from around the world. This is what we bring to you today. We also have even further strengthened that educational model by providing for a master's degree. In other words, other countries have done the heavy lifting by developing the model, by testing it out, and we are bringing you a model that is even stronger than theirs. To enter our program, applicants must have a bachelor's degree, they must have a dental hygiene license, and they must have 2,400 hours of clinical experience. In other words, these are very experienced professionals with a substantial amount of education, training, and experience. No other program trains at this level for a master's degree, and yet those other programs around the world are successful. So our students will be trained to a high degree of skill on a focused cluster of procedures in a limited scope of practice. You may not be aware that Metropolitan State University is a leader in other areas of health care. We have a simulation center for patient safety. It was the first in Minnesota. We operate it in collaboration with health partners. Just like our current students and many working professionals who study with us, our OHP students will be fully trained in that facility to respond to medical emergencies. The OHP faculty are all university faculty. They're experienced instructors with demonstrated commitments to practice in public settings. Six of our dental faculty have taught at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry. Their areas of expertise include general, geriatric, pediatric, special needs dentistry, and oral surgery. Two of our faculty supervise University of Minnesota dental school graduates in their residencies at Hennepin County Medical Center. We are very proud of the stature of our faculty and of the coursework and clinical instruction they will deliver. Our students will receive clinical training in state-of-the-art facilities, including the simulation center. Further, rather than requesting new state funds to build duplicate teaching clinics, we've adopted a strategy from our colleagues at the University of Minnesota. Just as dental students spend part of their time training in the clinic at Hebbing Community College, we have formed a partnership with Normandale Community College so that our students will train in Normandale's fully equipped state-of-the-art facilities, which Senator Pappas's committee toured in the fall. Because of our commitment to the communities we serve, we are also making arrangements to teach in another state-of-the-art instructional clinic on St. Paul's east side. Finally, I would like to note that our program is financially sound. It works for several reasons. One is because, of course, of the subsidy that the state legislature provides through its biennial allocation to MNSCU. Second is we have a very cost-effective delivery model for our education. Our students pay for education, nothing else. They don't pay stadium fees. They don't support athletics. It's a very cost-effective model. Secondly, we fully use partnerships, which further reduces our cost for facilities and training sites. And finally, we have a unique model of staffing where we use community faculty. These are working professionals, practicing professionals in the community. And those dentists are able will be able to instruct our students without having to become full-time paid employees of the MNSCU system. In this difficult economic time, we are very pleased to propose a model that will substantially improve health care without requiring additional state investment. Metropolitan State University is proud to bring this initiative forward. It is time to move ahead conservatively but confidently and launch the Oral Health Practitioner Initiative in Minnesota. The children are waiting, the elderly are waiting, and the community clinics are waiting. Minnesota has a reputation nationally for being a leader in progressive public policy, and we believe it is time for Minnesota to exercise that leadership in this regard as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This concludes the testimony of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
Thank you, Dr. Hammersmith.
Mr. Chair, at this time I'd like to call forward Dr. Ron Nagel and Dr. Ken Torbert. Mr. Chair and members, Dr. Nagel comes to us today from the Alaskan Native Tribal Consortium. Dr. Ken Torbert joins us today from Saskatchewan, Canada. And I know that you join me in expressing thanks. I think this is a real treat and privilege for this body to be able to hear from some this expert testimony today. And we'll begin with Dr. Nagel.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Ron Nagel. I am the Alaska Area Dental Director responsible for federal oral health activities in the state of Alaska. And I'm also designated as the consultant for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. And I thank you for inviting me. I'm not here to advocate on behalf of any specific legislation, rather just to provide information about our experiences developing our Alaska program. The consortium is where the tribal entities in Alaska come together to develop area-wide programs. And I have worked with dental therapists while stationed in the Western Pacific for about 6 years and with dental therapists currently practicing in Alaska for the past 4 years. I'm the principal investigator for a Kellogg Foundation grant aimed at developing dental therapists for the Alaska programs in collaboration with the medical school from the University of Washington. There are 14 dental therapists currently practicing in Alaska and another 14 in training in our own program, and I'm responsible for oversight of curriculum development, training, and certification of these new providers in our state. I want to talk a little bit about training because that seems to be a subject that often comes up regarding what we're doing. The first three cohorts of dental therapists called dental health aid therapists in our state graduated from Otago University in a two-year program. And that program has existed for about 88 years, and then they returned to Alaska. In September of 2006, the Alaska tribes began to develop their own training program for dental therapists. And this was the first of its kind in the nation. There's been a long history, as I'm sure you realize, of opposition to any changes in the dental workforce, and there's been a number of attempts by U.S. dental schools to deliver similar education programs dating back all the way to 1949. In each of those cases, attempts were thwarted by organized dentistry. And more recently, a tremendous political pressure was brought to bear on the University of Washington's dental school in response to our partnership by the local dental society, the alumni, the American Dental Association. So efforts to control the scope and training and supervision of your oral health practitioner should be looked upon as a part of this continued effort by the profession to maintain a status quo and return to the familiar. An OHP working under indirect or direct supervision would be little more than an expanded function dental assistant and have minimal, if any, effect on access here. It is clear that U.S. dental schools are inextricably connected to organized dentistry, the accreditation process, which is operated by the ADA, and component dental societies of the ADA, the alumni, and a century-old paradigm of educating dentists. It will be extremely difficult for any dental school to deliver this new education program free from this sort of influence. Fortunately, dental schools are not the only places that can provide education for dental therapists or OHPs. The Canadian Dental Therapy Program and our own Alaska-based Dental Therapy Program are models where dental therapy is not taught in a dental school. These are examples of cost-effective two-year programs that seek to educate students from underserved communities and help support them so that they return to those same communities to provide services. In our case, identifying students who are connected to their communities has been proven much more important than who does the training. The development of an Alaska-based education program has not created a second tier of care or a lower quality of care. It has enabled us to better tailor the training to meet the needs of our patients and to bring the training closer to home and improve retention of the students who are involved in this training. The safety net providers who will have primary responsibility for the OHP should be involved in the training and the development of the curriculum, and that's to ensure the end result will meet the needs of these patient populations. In our case, these are some of the best instructors. With these issues in mind, I urge you to enact legislation that will allow for multiple venues for training the OHP. Another area that often comes up related to what we're doing is supervision. And in 2008, I collaborated on a paper that was published in the International Dental Journal that examined the practice of dental therapy in 52 countries. In nearly every case, dental therapists provide their services under general supervision without the dentist present. Expanding access and creating a safety net call for the establishment of more entry points into the oral health care system. In order for the OHP to be successful, they must practice their scope in communities and populations where there are no dentists and under general supervision. Clinical guidance is the professional support and assistance provided to a dental therapist or OHP by their supervising dentist as part of the provision of overall integrated care. Our counterparts in medicine and other dental therapy programs have proven that clinical guidance can be provided at a distance as long as appropriate mechanisms exist to facilitate that exchange. In practical terms, dentists have to recognize the OHP as a skilled practitioner, and what oversight really means is periodic review of clinical records and other patient-related factors and quality assurance programs. Competency and quality, I think, I've heard quite a bit about these issues, and they've played an important role in the development of our program. And we've done quite a bit of research in this area as a result. There is no evidence to support claims that the services provided by dental therapists are unsafe or of poor quality. Virtually all of the existing literature suggests just the opposite. And, of course, my own firsthand experience working in the Western Pacific and Alaska has confirmed for me that dental therapists are safe, effective, and provide high-quality care where it's needed. Referencing routine oral health care procedures as irreversible surgical procedures is simply a scare tactic that detracts from meaningful discussions surrounding the development of new providers or addressing quality issues. We all should be concerned with the quality of care any new provider delivers. The only way to monitor quality is through an ongoing quality assurance program that evaluates performance over time. Altering the scope or supervision of a practitioner does not assure quality. A scope of practice is another area that often comes up in these discussions. Dental therapy, and I assume the OHP will follow this, is a discrete healthcare discipline with a defined scope of practice and duties that are complementary to other members of the dental team. The oral health needs of the population should be the driving factor used to determine determine the scope of practice. The dental therapists in Alaska participate in an intensive two-year training program that focuses on clinical competency, and the students in our program perform comparably large numbers of procedures during their training that are within their scope. An important emphasis in the design of a new provider education program should be aimed at solidifying providers' ability to recognize their scope and perform as part of an integrated team, requesting consultations and making referrals when appropriate. These elements should be competencies built in the curriculum, and this is what enables them to work under general supervision. Just in summary, in order to increase capacity, providers like OHP will need to operate under general supervision and create more entry points. Their scope needs to include important elements to the safety net, enabling them to address pain, infection, and function of teeth, in addition to the preventive measures. We're talking about fillings and extractions. And these are minimally invasive procedures that are so important to patients that there is simply no support for a program that does not address these issues. If we are truly concerned with quality, then the OHP program should employ a quality assurance program. Non-traditional education venues like ours may offer distinct benefits in preparing and supporting new providers at this early stage, and they may also offer some insulation from opposing political efforts. Thank you for your invitation to participate in the hearing and share some of my experiences. Please call on me if I can be of any further service, and please consider coming to Alaska and visiting our dental therapy program. Thank you.
Dr. Nagel, real quickly, how far apart are these practitioners practicing?
They're in communities that can be up to over 500 miles from the nearest dental office where there are dentists. And we have 200 villages that are not connected by the road system, so some of them can be very remote. While others practice in traditional settings, and some are practicing alongside dentists, in some of our larger communities.
Mr. Chair, Dr. Norbert will join us. Torbert.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Ken Torbert. I'm a semi-retired public health dentist who graduated from the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry in 1962. 47 years, I just added it up. And a master's in public health from the same school in 1972. Worked for the Methodist in between there in India. For 15 years, I've been training people at the National School of Dental Therapy in the province of Saskatchewan. And I've been working with and supervising dental therapists for the 25 years before becoming an educator. Ideally, the ones that we've been working with were trained for remote communities, which means that they worked from 9 until 3 o'clock with the school children, and then from 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock with emergencies for adults. Dental therapists have been practicing in Saskatchewan. The particular province that I'm working in now has about half of the dental therapists, and half of those work in private practice. I better stay with the script. Dental therapists have been practicing in Saskatchewan for 35 years and have been self-regulated professionals. During this time, dental therapists have helped to increase the access to oral care as part of their dental health, both in public and private practice settings, alongside dentists. Sorry.
A little closer.
Thank you. Do I get to go over it again? Both public and private practice settings alongside dentists, hygienists, and assistants. As members of the multidisciplinary teams, dental therapists provide the restorative dental treatment services, disease prevention, oral health promotion, and advocate for the need of of clients, assist them in assessing care, and refer patients to other professionals for service beyond the scope of the dental therapist's practice. Dental therapists can legally provide all services within their scope of practice, including but not just limiting to examinations, diagnosis of decay, local anesthetic, radiographs, routine fillings, and extractions of both primary and permanent teeth, not uncomplicated ones, and pulpotomies. These services can be provided in public and in private practices under what's called a consultative and referral relationship with the dentist, commonly referred to as a general supervision. About 130 dental therapists are employed by or work under contract dentists in private practice in our two major cities, in Saskatoon and in Regina. If there was a concern about competency, patient safety, or of quality of service provided by dental services, we would have received complaints from the dentists they are supervised or associated with, or from the public. Until last year, no dental therapist has ever been cited for either professional misconduct or professional incompetence. In 2007, a dental therapist was found guilty of professional misconduct, failed to, well, let me explain. He was my student, and I'm still mad. He came from Poland, and he was a qualified dentist in Poland and had qualified to take our course. So we trained him for 2 years, and then he went far beyond the scope as a dental therapist, and we're still unhappy. All dental therapists are required to maintain independent malpractice insurance, $205 a month. I pay that. No, a $205. Sorry, $205 a year is what they pay. I pay more than that every month for my malpractice. I wonder who's supposed to be. I wonder if the insurance companies know something we don't know. There has never been an insurance claim against a dental therapist's independent professional liability insurance or against a policy held by the employer, contractor, or dental therapist. A curriculum review was carried out by the College of Dentistry at the University of Saskatchewan, which is an accredited dental college, showed that dental therapists are trained to at least the same level of competency or greater than the dental students for the same competencies within their shared scopes of practice. The number of course hours for both the diagnostic and clinical requirements for competencies within the more limited scopes of practice of dental therapists far exceeds the requirement of dental students, for instance, 2,500 hours in a two-year program. Dental therapist students are required to treat many more patients and demonstrate their competencies more often during the training than dentists do. So each dental therapy program that has been created to this point has been to a target population, and they've all been successful, whether it was New Zealand trying to figure out how they're going to get their school kids under control, or whether it was Canada or Alaska and how do we work with remote communities. There are 52 countries out there who have dental therapists working in their totaling more than 14,000 dental therapists. That was by a 2007 survey. So we're convinced that these are such. You're looking at a dentist who still goes out and examines for my dental therapist. I go out for 2 days and take care of all the kindergarten, first, second, and third graders, and they got enough work there for the next 6 months. And I might hear from them by telephone for the next during that 6 months. And you'll never see another dentist who's been as happy and as delighted with being in the profession as this one. And it's all because of a bunch of dental therapists. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Dr. Torbert, you mentioned 35 years without any lawsuits or whatever. And I'm wondering, because we keep being told that a simple filling becomes really complicated in the middle of it, and if there's not a dentist on hand, how you do that for 35 years? Do you not have that kind of problem?
They still happen. And occasionally they'll phone on those. Most of the time they'll put a simple stainless steel crown over them. They know how to handle these after several years and turn them over and refer them to the dentist. I often get those kind of conversations going, and it's very often I say, come on, it's over your head. Move them out to the dentists who are available, one way or another. I don't know how to explain, but it is handled relatively easy.
35 years without a problem.
I mean,
the problem occurs, but it's taken care of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they worry about bleeding and all kinds of things with surgery. Well, my goodness, out there in the remote communities, they clip off toes and have shotgun wounds and everything, and they know really how to handle that stuff. I should also explain that dental therapists don't necessarily work under me. More often they're working for nurse practitioners, who they get their orders from and who supply them with drugs and that sort of thing.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if Dr. Nagel would care to comment.
Well, I think there's two issues related to that. One is their training helps them understand their scope, and by incorporating that as a competency in their training, they avoid most of those problems that come into the clinic by reviewing the patient records and through health history. And they're also able to get consultations from the dentist, as Dr. Torbert mentioned. And so we're talking about very small numbers of procedures that need to be referred in. And, of course, the last resort is to call the dentist or refer the patient in for help if it's necessary. But that actually doesn't happen nearly as often as some folks would like us to believe.
Thank you. Your next witness, or did you have a clarification question? We'd rather keep the debate types of things.
No.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a debate, just a quick comment. And I want to thank you, Senator Lynch, for looking to our neighbors to the north, both in Canada and Alaska, for some of these answers to our problems here at home. 52 countries practicing, in another style. Just, I think, is a real powerful lesson that we as Minnesotans and Americans can learn something from our global neighbors. So I appreciate you bringing these testifiers in.
Mr. Chair, at this time I'd like to call up Shelley Gashan from Pew Center on the States.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, can you hear me? Okay, good. It's my luck to follow the funny guy. I worked for NCSL for 9 years, and at that time I remember thinking that Minnesota, it was well known as one of the handful of states that was a leader in health policy, and it's good to know that you still are. It's really exciting what you're working on today. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Shelley Geshen, and I'm the director of the Advancing Children's Dental Health Initiative for the Pew Center on the States. The Children's Dental Health Initiative is a 5-year project to advance state policies that will dramatically improve children's lives. Dental care is the most prevalent unmet need among children. Dental problems impair children's ability to learn, play, and interact with their families and peers. Enduring dental pain from untreated cavities is unimaginable to most of us for even a day, let alone weeks or months. But that is the reality for many low-income children. Some problems may be intractable, but this one is not. The legislation you're considering today would create a new primary care dental professional that's similar to those used in Alaska and so many countries around the world. This professional would strengthen dental care just as nurse practitioners and physician assistants have strengthened medical care. The safety, quality, and effectiveness of these providers is well established. Rigorous research shows that they perform their duties as competently as dentists. The educational levels being contemplated in this legislation exceed what other countries require, but the net result would be the addition of a competent, trusted member of the health professions that would greatly increase the level of dental care available in Minnesota. The intent is not to supplant dentists, but to round out the dental team. A mid-level practitioner would help bolster the capacity of community health centers and other safety net settings, thereby expanding access to quality dental care for children and other underserved people. These new providers, by one estimate, could be trained to do about 25% to 30% of the services that dentists are trained to do, such as cleanings and extractions and filling cavities, but could perform many of the services that children most commonly need. Dentists will always be needed for more complex procedures and for more complex patients, but if they so choose, they could have these new mid-levels and delegate routine work to them. Access to dental care for low-income children has been a vexing and persistent problem. It is the most, dental decay is the most common childhood disease and is almost universal. By comparison, asthma affects only 11% of children. Overall, the problem of poor dental health falls disproportionately on the poor. 80% of pediatric dental disease is concentrated in 25% of children, primarily those from low-income and minority households. Most people don't really understand that there really is no safety net for dental care. You can't go to a dental emergency room like you could if you broke your arm, go to an emergency room in most communities. The bedrock of the dental safety net, though, is community health centers. But nationally, only about 1 in 10 patients, people who lack access to dental care can get it from a safety net provider. Almost 20% of the positions for dentists in community health centers are vacant because there are no providers who are willing or able to practice there. The vacancy rate is nearly 30% in rural areas. These new professionals could treat patients at community health centers who lack sufficient providers. In all states, there is a shortage of dentists who can treat children, particularly young children. There are way too few dentists in rural areas, in low-income urban areas, and who will accept Medicaid and CHIP. The pressure to look for workforce models to improve access is large and it's growing. More needs to be done, and these bills that you're considering, a new provider would be a big step in the right direction. Around the world, including in Great Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, there are primary dental care providers called dental nurses or dental therapists. They complete a rigorous 2-year training program that is similar to the last 2 years of dental school, except they learn fewer procedures. They focus on patient-centered care for both adults and children in schools, in clinics, and in private practices. Around the world, though, some countries are moving towards an oral health practitioner model that is a 3-year program that combines both dental therapy and dental hygiene. So the legislation you are considering today is really very similar. As you know, regulation of the health professions falls squarely on the shoulders of state policymakers. The goal of state regulation, though, is to ensure the safety of the public and to ensure the public has access to care. It's not just safety. Each decision you make has to balance costs and benefits. So the first question to answer is, how will these new providers be used and how will they fit into the healthcare system? If they are to be used in underserved areas, then they can function in a hub and spoke system with supervising dentists at the hub and the new providers a phone call and internet hookup away from a real-time consult. This is 2009, when technology means that supervision does not have to be on-site to work. My recommendation is that there should be general supervision under standing orders. There are several other terms that mean the same thing, but I think that is what would work best. This is not a safety issue and will in no way put patients at risk. Under general supervision, these new providers will have specific instructions about what cases they can take, what treatment they can provide on their own, which cases they can't take, and a requirement to get approval for any case they are not sure of. Most discussions about workforce begin with an assumption that dentists can do anything that their patients require and can do it better than any non-dentist could. But that isn't really true. In other countries, the 2-year dental therapist program includes 760 hours of clinical training on treating children. And by comparison, dental students in this country have much less experience with children, receiving only 171 hours on average in pediatric dentistry. While dentists are trained to clean teeth, 77% of general practitioners and 88% of periodontists actually employ hygienists to clean their patients' teeth. So they're trained to do a lot of things that they delegate instead of doing themselves or refer to other dentists. According to the American Dental Association, 43% of patient visits are for hygiene services. That means in today's private practices, the first provider who does a diagnosis and provides treatment, they can call it an assessment, but it is a diagnosis, and of course the treatment in this case is cleaning, is the hygienist. Ultimately, these new oral health professionals will become a major source of patient visits via referral and will allow dentists in clinics and private dental practices to see more patients, improve efficiency, and devote more time to more complex patients and procedures. There are many research studies from other countries in the United States that show that providers other than dentists can be taught in short periods to pull teeth and fill cavities with the quality and consistency that is equal to that of dentists. The question about scope of services is, what are the needs for underserved patients who are not being seen by private practices? If you can teach students who become dentists to perform these services safely, then you can teach students who become dental therapists or oral health practitioners to perform them safely. Private practice dentists deliver nearly 90% of the care in this country, and the safety net delivers 10%. These new primary care providers will bolster the 10%. They'll increase the number of patients who can be cared for in underserved areas. These are vulnerable, low-income children and adults whom private dentists do not treat. This new position is a common-sense safety net solution to deliver high-quality care to people who otherwise would not get it. When the field of dental hygiene was created, it took nearly 40 years for all states to license them. But now dental practice is unimaginable without hygienists. I urge you to enact legislation that creates new mid-level providers. I and the Pew Center on the States will be ready to help you at any point along the way. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Gashan. Senator Lynch, for your remaining witnesses, if you could try and do it in about 8 minutes. I know you'll have to prioritize some that way.
Mr. Chair, happy to accommodate. At this time, I'd like to call Dr. Craig Amundson, Dr. Patricia Tarin, and Dr. Vacherie Peterson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Craig Amundson. I practice dentistry with Health Partners and served as its dental director from 1980 through 2008. I was a member of the Oral Health Practitioner Work Group and appreciated the opportunity to represent MNSCU in that process, and I'm a member of the Curriculum Advisory Committee to Metropolitan State University's Oral Health Practitioner Master's Program. I'm testifying on behalf of myself and representing Health Partners. We fully support this bill. We believe that we will be able to develop practice opportunities for oral health practitioners as supported by this legislation. We anticipate they will be valuable members of our dental care delivery team in outreach setting and in certain medical practice settings with patients who need improved access to oral health care. Our support is based on the fact that this practitioner will be part of our oral health care delivery team. Our support is contingent upon a robust and comprehensive support structure, collaborative management agreement, and active dentist involvement. Additionally, this practitioner is almost the poster child for the recommendations made in the Minnesota Healthcare Transformation Task Force report, which calls on us to create expanded services for certain providers so that we can let higher level providers practice to the top of their license. I'd like to make a couple comments about safety and care delivery. Given the robust nature of the curriculum, the educational expertise that resides within the Minnesota State College and University system, and the unique resources which Metropolitan State University possesses, including the Health Partners Simulation Center for Patient Safety, I have full confidence that the patients cared for by oral health practitioners will be treated safely. Further, given that these practitioners will provide care under the direction of a dentist and will practice within specific guidelines with formal review and assessment, I fully expect that patients treated by these practitioners will be subject to less unexplained variation in clinical decision-making than in our broader practice community. Thank you, and I look forward to responding to any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Amundson. I'll just go unless people need questions. Go ahead.
My name is Patricia Tarin, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm a pediatric dentist practicing and teaching at Hennepin County Medical Center for the past 15 years. I've also been on the faculty of the University of Minnesota teaching pediatric dentistry for the past 31 years. At Hennepin County Medical Center, I teach general practice, dental residents, the care of children, as well as special needs adults and medically compromised adults. I represent Hennepin County Medical Center on the Oral Health Committee of the Safety Net Coalition, and I'm testifying on behalf of myself and the Safety Net Coalition, and I'm in full support of Senator Lynch's bill. My background includes dental education in London, England, where I graduated in 1974, And that, following that, I had the opportunity to work with four dental therapists. And based on that experience, I was glad to join the advisory committee for the curriculum development at Metropolitan State University 2 years ago, and have worked alongside Dr. Amundsen on that. And I'm a strong proponent of this bill.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Valerie Peterson. I am a practicing dentist and CEO of Community Dental Care, a nonprofit dental clinic with two clinics in St. Paul, hiring over 100 employees. Our mission is to provide quality dental care for low-income and minority families and children. Currently, 90% of our patients are on public programs. This year, we estimate that both of our clinics will provide 40,000 patient encounters. In 1992, my husband and I spent 6 weeks in a refugee camp in Thailand teaching preventive oral hygiene. We also taught simple extraction techniques to 8 young Hmong men so they could help one dentist serving 54,000 patients. In the year 2008, our clinic provided training for 60 dental professional students. After these students graduated, we hired 6 of them who wanted to come back to work at our clinic with the needy population. Every single one of them had done an outstanding job. This year, we have signed agreement with 5 colleges and universities to clinically train 74 students. I have also agreed to work with the Minsky program to help train their OHP students in our clinic. As our newest clinic continues to grow, we look forward to hiring some of these students after they graduate. I support this bill. As important as the new OHP bill is, it's also important that we preserve adult dental benefits. They go hand in hand to improve dental access in Minnesota. This is a time to be putting our patients' needs first. Thank you kindly.
Thank you very much. We have about 2 minutes left, Senator Lynch, so please prioritize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sarah Wolfka.
Good afternoon. I'm Sarah Wolfcha, the Director of Children's Dental Services, which is one of Minnesota's largest providers of care to low-income children. We currently provide care to over 18,000 low-income children in Minnesota annually, over more than 50,000 patient encounters. And we provide care not only in the Twin Cities metro area, but also in St. Cloud, Duluth, and up across the Iron Range. And one of the major problems that we have is a serious shortage of dental providers to serve the children in need. I have an ongoing posting for dentists. We always have at least a shortage of one full-time dentist. Currently, we're short 3 full-time dentists. So there's a crisis in terms of access to care, and we would easily be able to serve an additional 10,000 children across the state if we had adequate providers to meet that need. Children's Dental Services wholeheartedly supports this initiative and is committed to serve as a site to hire at least 5 oral health practitioners upon graduation. And with me also today is David Pena, who is a parent of children who are served by Children's Dental Services and is here to say a few words about how critical safety net providers are to him and his family.
Thank you, Mr. Pena. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is David Pena, and if it wasn't for the Children's Health Center, my children wouldn't have no place to go to get their teeth fixed unless they went to an adult services, which I think they wouldn't be comfortable with the Children's Health Center over here. They felt comfortable with the staff there, helped them, showed them what to do with their teeth and how to clean their teeth. And the second time around, my son Luke, Michael, David Pena, and Jacintia Lynn Pena were both happy to go back there again to get their teeth cleaned. They were excited about it. And to this day, day and morning, they brush their teeth.
Thank you very much. Senator Lynch, I think we're not going to have time for the other witnesses. I apologize for that, but we've got to keep moving on the time. And with that, what we're going to do is set aside this bill. This is the bill we're going to be acting on later, and I've told both sides to draft amendments to that bill if so. But now we're going to have Senator Pretner Solon present. Senator Torres-Ray.
I have a question.
Please go ahead.
I have a chance to ask. I'm just curious, Senator Lynch, about some language that is in here, and I don't know how this is determined. How does the state determine areas where we have low-income, uninsured, underserved patients or are located in dental health professional shortage areas? How do we determine what those areas are in the state of Minnesota? Do we have a system in place or?
Mr. Chair, the work group looked at existing criteria to use so that we wouldn't have to create new, and in most cases we've listed in the bill places that, for one example, is we do have a program that allows collaborative practice dental hygienists to serve safety net populations, so we've just adopted that definition of safety net populations. And then also have other criteria that, if we can find the page, that in it. It's back here somewhere. 15.
Page 15.
It starts on 15, line 16. It's the definition section, and it lists a number of. Another example of existing criteria is the state has a critical access dental provider program, and that uses a well-defined definition to determine those dental clinics that have high percentages of low-income and Medicaid patients, and then those providers are eligible for an enhanced payment. So that's another group that would be then eligible to have an oral health practitioner. Others kind of listed here, the VA would be a possibility for patients that are receiving home care services, and homebound is also listed here. And then there are criteria, too, for determining what's called a medically underserved area, which would be like a rural community that doesn't have enough practitioners. And so we would be using the health department's definitions for identifying which areas are health professional shortage areas, and that then would trigger the eligibility to have those practitioners.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Berglund, question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question actually for both bills, and so I thought maybe this would be the best time to ask it. And the question would be for Dr. Hammersmith and Dean Lloyd, and that would be that we inevitably are going to be facing budget cuts this year. And so I'd like to know from both of them if they're committed to going forward with these new programs, regardless of what the budget cuts might be.
Dr. Henderson.
Yes, we are committed to go forward. And let me tell you what our situation is. This program, it has a very cost-effective delivery mechanism. It will be funded by the graduate tuition and special course fees that the students will pay. And at Metropolitan State University also, being the most affordable university in the state, our enrollments are up 9% this spring. So we're not being in a position of having to lay people off as some of the outstate institutions are. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I heard you say you're committed to this program
yes.
regardless of budget
yes.
cuts.
Thank you.
Thank you. So we're ready for Senator Pretner Solon's bill then.
No, I saw him.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 641 contains some alternative language to Senator Lynch's oral health practitioner bill. This bill will create a mid-level dental therapist position that would be educated at the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, be able to provide a range of preventative and basic surgical procedures to underserved populations throughout the state, and be supervised by a dentist in a way that ensures safety for the patient and flexibility for the worker. This bill is backed by the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, the Minnesota Dental Association, the Academy of General Dentistry, and the Minnesota Dental Assistance Association. And it is consistent with the recently announced position of the Board of Dentistry. Requiring dental therapists to be educated alongside dental students creates a solid foundation from which to grow a dental team. Furthermore, the University of Minnesota is the only institution in the state that is accredited to teach surgical dental procedures. This proposal offers a very open education track, where Senator Lynch's proposal is limited to a dental hygienist with a BA degree. This program would be open to everyone. Students out of high school could enroll in the dental therapy program. They would be taking training similar and often identical to that provided to dental students. If a dental therapist chooses to become a dentist in the future, the prerequisite courses he or she studied to become a dental therapist could be counted toward the dental degree. The dental school would also offer a master's degree in dental therapy, where those same dental hygienists would be eligible for the degree in Senator Lynch's bill, could get a master's degree at the University of Minnesota while training with the very dentists that would likely employ them in the future. The open BA and MA approach makes more sense than a program limited to only dental hygienists. Once in the workforce, this bill requires a dentist to be on site whenever a dental therapist performs a surgical procedure. This is just good dentistry and common sense. Dentists have mentioned countless situations to me where a procedure that seems simple quickly turned into a dental emergency. This new worker will only have a few years of training and may not be readily equipped to handle the multitude of problems that could arise. When a mid-level worker performs any surgical procedures, a dentist must be on site to help out or take over the procedure if the patient's circumstances warrant it. Senate File 641 accounts for the paramount concern of patient safety while expanding access to those who need it the most. Other groups at the legislature are trying to make this new dental worker position as broad as possible, allowing them to perform complicated, irreversible procedures without a dentist nearby. This is unacceptable and the wrong way to expand dental care. Instead, we need a clear vision of what the position will look like and thoughtful planning to ensure that they truly allow more Minnesotans to have access to quality oral health care. We should also move slowly at first to determine how this new worker fits into the dental delivery system. We can always expand the scope of practice of this professional once we have had some time to assess its efficacy. We should be proud that Minnesota is blazing the way in this new area, but we need to get it right. We must create a new dental worker that is trained at an accredited institution, qualified to teach oral surgical procedures, and then supervised in a common sense and effective way, ensuring that Minnesotans get the dental care they deserve while strengthening and expanding the entire dental team. And Mr. Chair, now I would like to have Dean Lloyd walk through the bill and offer his comments.
Dean Lloyd, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm Patrick Lloyd, Dean of the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry, and it's a pleasure to be here today, and I'm happy and pleased to represent the University of Minnesota, which is the only dental school in the state of Minnesota, the only institution accredited to teach dentistry procedures. I have two handouts for you. One is a PowerPoint presentation that I'll be giving this evening to Representative Tao's subcommittee. And the other is the answer to questions that have been either emailed or telephoned or handed to me at meetings that we've been at the last several months. I'd like you to consider these as resources for the subsequent months of discussion. I appreciate to be able to speak this afternoon in support of legislation introduced by Senator Pretner-Solon and Representative Norton that will improve access to care in the state of Minnesota. I'd first like to point out the highlights of the bill that are key elements that we consider important in the education and training of dental therapists. And I'll refer to lines specifically, beginning with line 1.18, the practice of dental therapy. We've identified three particular areas of interest, one being that these providers would work under the supervision of a Minnesota licensed dentist, two, practice in settings that serve low-income and underserved patients or are located in dental health professional shortage areas, and three, provides oral health care services including preventive, evaluative, and educational services as authorized under Section 150A.105 and within the context of a collaborative agreement. Next is line 3.5, identifying dental therapists, particularly that these be people of good moral character who have graduated from a dental therapy education program in a dental school or dental college accredited by the Commission on Dental Accreditation. Secondly, that prior to being licensed, the applicant would have passed a comprehensive competency-based clinical examination that is approved by the Board of Dentistry and administered independently of an institution providing dental therapy education. These two points are critical as we have learned about the advantages of a dental school-based program and recognizing that the profession to best receive this member into the dental team should go through the same sort of educational experiences and be tested for clinical competency similarly to a practicing dentist. Next point, 11.2, the practice settings would be limited primarily to those settings that serve low-income and underserved patients or in dental health professional shortages areas. We identify in section 11.4 and beyond the collaborative agreement opportunities for this provider. These would list primarily primary care services, and they are listed on that area all the way down from 11.4 up into and including 12.3. 12.4 talks about the specifics of the scope of practice, detailing what experiences would allow them to provide care under a collaborative agreement, again, primarily of a preventive nature. 12.24 lists those procedures that could be provided under the indirect supervision of a dentist, meaning that they would be available for pre-treatment evaluation to manage circumstances that occur during the performance of care and to assist in unanticipated complications during the provision of care. 13.11 identifies those services that we would educate them to a competency level to provide under direct supervision. That would mean that the dentist is seeing the patient before and after the procedure. 13.18 specifies that the dispensing authority would include allowing therapists to dispense and administer drugs within the parameters of the collaborative agreement and within the scope of practice of dental therapists. These include analgesics, anti-inflammatory agents, and antibiotics. 13.34 indicates that they would have the opportunity to supervise no more than two registered or unregistered dental assistants. 14.4 indicates that the practice settings would be specific for low-income and underserved populations with additional descriptions thereafter. Specifically in 14.18, we indicate that they must practice in clinical settings that include or that could include populations where at least 50% of the total patient base are in clinics or in practice settings consisting of patients who are either enrolled in the Minnesota healthcare program, have a medical disability or chronic condition that creates a significant barrier to receiving dental care, or do not have dental health coverage either through a public health care program or private insurance, or have an annual gross family income equal to or less than 200% of the federal poverty guidelines. And finally, under 15.23, we have a long list of those outcomes that we would measure in order to determine whether or not these graduates end up providing care in communities that are most in need and that there's an economic advantage to the model that we've created to train dental therapists. I'd like to say a few words about the bill on how the University of Minnesota School of Dentistry has created this new mid-level provider program, but I first wanted to provide an update on what we've done over the past year since the 2008 legislation passed the law creating the dental therapist profession. And you can follow along my handout, again, used as a resource for subsequent referral. First, I and Chris Blue, the director of our dental hygiene program, contributed to the 8 meetings of the Oral Health Care Practitioner Workgroup. Second, in preparation for our role, we organized visits to 3 well-established dental therapy programs, one in Canada, one in New Zealand, and 2 in England. Included in our delegation were 4 additional School of Dentistry faculty with expertise in restorative dentistry, oral medicine, pediatric dentistry, and general practice. We also invited 6 other members of the work group to join us so that they too could get firsthand knowledge of how dental therapists were being educated and practiced. These sites were designed for us to specifically allow us to contain direct information from the program directors, faculty, students, and practicing dental professionals. We viewed educational facilities and looked at the impact of each healthcare system on their programs. This includes the impact on education, tuition dollars, and practice opportunities. Third, we convened University of Minnesota School of Dentistry faculty to contribute to the Oral Health Care Practitioner Workgroup, and we formed a curriculum steering committee. Because a dental therapist will perform procedures until now performed only by dentists, the curriculum steering committee established some guiding principles. First, the standard of care taught to dental therapists would be identical to that taught to our dental students. The scope of practice competency requirements for dental therapists will be identical to those applied to dental students. Examination, diagnosis, and treatment planning would remain the purview of the dentist. Health promotion and disease prevention will be core elements of the educational program. Irreversible surgical procedures would be performed under the indirect supervision of the dentist, again, which means that the dentist would be available in the clinic. Our program would be structured to complement rather than compete with other healthcare professionals. Graduates would contribute to reducing the cost of care and to improving access underserved populations. And the education would occur in a professional environment that includes dental hygienists, dentists to ensure graduates are prepared to work in a team setting. Our graduates will be able to find career opportunities, and the program would be replicable to other dental schools. Next, the School of Dentistry created a curriculum identifying faculty to train and educate our dental therapy programs and determine the facility enhancements that would be needed to provide such a program. And I brought along with me as a reference the 2 curricula, one for the bachelor's program and one for our master's program. It was important early in our discussions to distinguish one discipline from another so that we could create a curriculum that would be complementary rather than competitive. And so one of your images, I point out the differences between the discipline of dental hygiene, that discipline that uses hand instruments and works outside the tooth to improve the health of gum tissues and prevent decay, as compared to dental therapists who use drills to cut into teeth, remove decay, and special devices to place and finish fillings and surgical instruments to extract teeth. We've developed 2 programs, one an undergraduate Bachelor of Science degree requiring 40 months of school after high school, a continuous full-time program, and our 28-month professional degree targeted adult learners that will be called a Master of Dental Therapy. 2 programs, same license. The master's program would allow us to provide additional education for individuals enrolled in the program that would encourage them to take on leadership roles, either as educators or facilitators in communities to better use the dental therapist in our healthcare delivery system. I've included illustrations that depict the distribution of time our students will spend in each aspect of their education. These colored diagrams in my image provided exposure to the progressive, basic, and applied integrated curriculum that our students would experience. We expect that graduates will have a significantly lower level of total educational debt than other members of the oral health care team, which will reduce the cost of providing dental care once they are practicing. The legislation will require that half of the dental therapist patients are on medical assistance or below the 200% federal poverty level. One of the most significant approaches to our program is that a dentist, dental hygienist, and dental therapist must work together as a team. Our curriculum will allow students to learn together so that they can practice together. Our graduates must be well prepared to manage and care for patients from diverse backgrounds, including recent immigrants from non-English-speaking countries, places where healthcare delivery systems are not well developed, and areas of the world where dental care is suboptimal. Finally, the School of Dentistry prides itself on having experienced faculty with training to teach all aspects of dental therapy education. By way of comparison, the position is modeled after the physician's assistant program. And the most significant advantage of the dental school-based program has its ability to train a single standard of care, thus ensuring public trust and the respect of the profession. We believe this new program will be a model for improving access to dental care. It will build on our work since 2000 when we increased the class size of the dental school by 37%. We've also created and instituted new efforts to improve access to dental care, such as requirements that our students participate in two-month-long rotations at one of our seven outreach clinics in underserved areas of the state of Minnesota, where 85 to 90% of our patients are on public assistance. In addition, we treat patients at our East Bank University of Minnesota location, and later this year we'll be opening a new hospital-based clinic in July at the University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview, where we will train five dentists each year on how to care for underserved who are not only having complex dental treatment needs but are also medically compromised. Yet we know that this is not meeting the entire need. Our hope is that the new mid-level provider practitioner, this new member of the dental team, will help expand access to dental care. Now, I've listed for you in some of the final images the specifics of these services that would be provided under the license provided to our dental therapist. We will train to the competencies for those individual procedures listed as preventive services, restorative services, and surgical procedures. The terminology used is not intended to alarm or scare the public. Rather, it's intended to clarify for other healthcare professionals and the public the exact nature of procedures our students will be licensed to provide. We are ready with a curriculum for both programs and can begin accepting students for a fall class of 2009. The Board of Regents approved our programs on February 12th. The final steps we must take in addition to securing support include we will need to recruit new faculty members and staff. We will also require an expansion of our simulation clinic and clinical space. We also look to secure approvals from accrediting organizations and testing for applicants and graduates. We cannot implement this new program without funding from the legislature. I look forward to working with Senator Petner-Solon and Representative Norton as we advance this legislation, and I pause to answer questions you may have.
Thank you. Senator Berglund.
Well, Dean Light, I'm glad you clarified that this program would not go forward unless there's additional funding. And that is what makes me nervous about pitting these two bills against each other. I hope that this bill that you have goes forward and passes. And I hope it's implemented. But if something happens that you don't get the funding and it's not implemented, I don't want to see the other bill not make it as well.
Yeah, that was not a question as much as a comment.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. Do you have this bill in this committee? Is it in your possession?
It is in our possession, yes.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
I've suggested to both sides that they put amendments to Senator Lynch's bill for today.
Mr. Chairman, being that you have possession of the bill, that if somebody makes a motion, that can happen to move the bill forward, correct?
It's not on the agenda today. The bill number is not on the agenda today.
Okay, but we're hearing the bill.
I said we would present it for discussion purposes, because I think what we want to have is both sides be able to present their views. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing now.
But, Mr. Chairman, why wouldn't we have the bill before us and then hear the testimony? What's the difference between doing that, and is it a kind of a control thing? Or?
Senator Coring, I want to make sure that we have, this is the policy committee, we make the decisions here.
Right.
I want to make sure that we pass out one bill with whatever this committee wants in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've suggested that they can offer a delete everything amendment to the other one or add theirs on to the other one. I think I've heard Senator Berglund would like both to go. Some would like just one or the other to go. And what I'm suggesting is that the committee put together whatever it wants and pass it out.
Okay.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before I make my comment, I did want to say we do have Senate File 641 before us.
For discussion purposes, it's not on the agenda.
But it's actually on the table right here.
It's sitting in front of you, yes.
Yes,
correct.
It is. Thank you very much. My comment, Mr. Chairman, is to Mr. Lloyd. I wanted to say thank you in your presentation. You talked about how once you implement, you're going to go back and reexamine and make sure that you're meeting your goals as far as serving the underserved. I appreciate that, that you have that as part of your already planned out curriculum.
My comment, we are working closely with our School of Public Health, who have extensive experience, especially in rural health delivery systems, to make sure that the graduates from our program would, as we're describing it, increase the capacity of the existing network of providers in the state of Minnesota to see more patients, and with what we're calling an educationally, fiscally responsible model, reduce the cost of care delivery, not just the amount, but the cost of care delivery.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Mr. Lloyd. Going back to your comment, you made at the conclusion of your presentation that the next steps and the things that need to be done, and then you said that there'd be a need for additional funding to do this. Given the state of the budget, I guess it's questionable whether there would be additional funding, but what happens if we pass your bill and there is no funding? Does nothing happen, or would the university redeploy funds that it has and it are using in other ways? Or just what would happen if we just said, well, we like your bill, we're going to pass your bill, but we don't have any money? What would happen?
Well, as I've said to the maybe 30 representatives I've met with in the last month, I'm hoping that people will look at our bill as an example of innovation in healthcare delivery, not a dental project. And support what the legislature asked us to do last spring, was to create a program. As I said earlier, we've increased our dental school class size by nearly 40%. We've done some innovations in developing graduate programs for dental hygiene, and neither of these expansions and new programs required or took on any additional financial assistance from the state. I'm not able to absorb another program, 40-plus students, without additional assistance. So we were responding to the legislative need to create a program that would better serve the state, and I need the resources to expand facilities and to bring on, to recruit some faculty actually from places we visit in the world so that we could bring some of that special knowledge either from New Zealand or England to our university.
Can we proceed with the witnesses? Senator Pretner, so in, and then the witnesses.
Mr. Chair, just to some of the comments that have been made, I think I'm concerned about the debate and about its being picking winners or losers. And I think that our real debate should be about access to dental care for Minnesotans. I think both proposals would open that. And I would hate to pit one bill against the other. And unfortunately, though, the way it's set up now, seems like that's what would happen.
Senator Berglund, did you have?
So, Senator Pretner-Solon, as long as you brought up dental access, then I'd like to ask Mr. Lloyd if the governor's budget cuts in the Health and Human Services area regarding dental payments goes through, what will happen to this program and what will happen to the existing program at the University of Minnesota Dental School?
That compromises our efforts to educate students as well as take care of a substantial number of patients. 38% of our 105,000 patient visits last year were public assistance patients. 60% of those were adults. At our outreach clinics last year, we had 15,720 visits. 85% to 90% of those are public assistance. We met with probably 70 legislators in the last 3 weeks appealing for a reconsideration of the governor's recommendation to eliminate not only dental care for the adult, but the elimination of the critical access site. We are a safety net, probably the greatest proportion in the state, and we believe we've hired faculty, created facilities that allow us to take care of not only people that have substantial dental needs, but have concurrent medical, emotional, and physical disabilities that make our setting most able to care for them. I'm worried about the next generation of oral health care practitioners who could be deprived of that experience in our schools, whether it's our Twin Cities campus or outreach programs, to prepare them better to meet the needs of the underserved. And we're appealing as strongly as we can to make sure that that recommendation of the governor's doesn't go through.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that you do not support the cut, but I'm asking you, if the cut goes through, will you be able to continue operating the dental program you currently have?
We will be able to continue operating the program we have, yes.
And at what level would you be able to continue operating it?
You mean our conventional dental program and our dental hygiene programs?
Your dental training programs that you have today, yes.
It's going to require some restructuring. It's going to require that we look at some alternative delivery systems for educating. It's going to require that we seek some other sorts of funding to support some of the needs of the underserved that can't be sustained by state dollars. We've been successful with raising significant philanthropic support for our population served outside the Twin Cities area, then it would be that we would appeal to those groups to provide our outreach services support.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Dean, would you be able to also support the current program and move forward with this expanded program?
Well, as I said earlier, the expanded new program would require additional resources for us to make the facility enhancements and to recruit the faculty we need to carry on the new program. We're not looking to reduce our student body either in the DDS program or our dental hygiene program. We're the primary supplier of dental hygiene educators in the state. Over 50% of the dental hygiene educators have graduated from the U's dental hygiene program. And we supply 85% of the dentists, 90% for North Dakota, multiple dentists for South Dakota, Western Wisconsin, and Montana. We would not be able to continue providing that kind of level if we cut back.
So, Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to restate what I heard Mr. Lloyd say to me, and that is that this new program will not go forward if there is not additional funding for it to be paid for with state dollars.
Senator Pretner-Solon, you want to call your witnesses?
Yes, I'd like to call Dr. Scott Lingle and Dr. Mike Flynn.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dr. Scott Lingle. I'm a general dentist here in St. Paul, and I'm speaking for the Minnesota Dental Association, which represents about, actually over 80% of the dentists in Minnesota. Dental access is a problem we've struggled with for many years. Many things have been done to help, such as the Critical Access Provider Program you've heard about, collaborative agreements, the Donated Dental Services Program, community volunteer outreach clinics, Give Kids a Smile Program, restorative expanded functions. Right now, dentists are averaging over $35,000 a year in charitable dental care every year, and still we have these problems. Last year, we heard that some community clinics were not able to hire enough dentists, and so the bill was brought forth to establish the advanced hygiene practitioner. We oppose this bill because of an inadequate education and training for a surgical scope of practice that does not have the safety of Minnesota patients in mind. Not much has changed in this bill. The prerequisite education of a hygiene degree is not the same as a pre-dent or a pre-medical education. The OHP program is not the same as a dental education. Essentially, you're playing doctor without going to doctor school. We can teach people specific skills. Any oral surgery educator will tell you that they can teach a dental student or a dental therapy student to extract teeth. They will also tell you that they've seen their share of hematomas, facial nerves temporarily paralyzed, missed anesthetic blocks, root fractures, prolonged post-op bleeding, pain, occasional infections. The mechanics of giving an injection and removing a tooth are only one aspect of the care in this situation, and they can be mastered by the dental student or the therapist student. What requires more complex training and experience is the intellectual aspects of the care. This includes deciding that the tooth needs removal, or is there some other treatment that could save it? Determining if the patient's health requires modification of the choice of anesthesia, or how the patient needs to be managed in the perioperative period. Assessing the patient's emotional state to decide if local anesthesia alone is adequately going to handle their pain and anxiety. Being able to foresee problems with the extraction on routine imaging, or knowing whether or not we have to get additional images. Knowing what to do if the tooth is not responding to the usual methods used to remove the tooth. The list goes on and on. This is why if you teach someone just to do the mechanics, you need a doctor on site qualified in the intellectual aspects of the care. Before treatment, during treatment, and after treatment. Not just a paper supervision where the dentist might not even be physically in the state while the treatment is occurring. Can the mechanics be taught? Yes, we've heard that. But they should be taught to the same expertise level as a dentist. The U of M is the only school accredited to teach these surgical dental procedures. It's a state-of-the-art facility designed specifically for that and has a faculty fine-tuned specifically for that. The therapist would be trained alongside the dentist. They would be part of the dental team from day one. Why would we want anything less than that? There are two bills that present a new dental provider. The easy thing to do would be to vote yes on both bills. But the easy thing is not always the right thing. Minnesota is not a remote tundra like parts of Alaska or a sparsely populated area like northern Saskatchewan. The rest of Canada doesn't even use that therapy model. We are Minneapolis and St. Paul, Wilmer and Baudette, different cities, but all within a couple hundred miles of each other. If we need a new member of the dental team, then let's make him or her the best that we can have. The people of Minnesota deserve the same high standard of care, regardless if they are fee-for-service or public care patients. Members of this committee, that's who you represent, the people of Minnesota, not Alaska or Canada. You have the opportunity to create a new member of the dental team. Please, let's do it right. I urge you to defeat Senate File 1106 and consider Senate File 641. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to present, and I'd like to publicly thank my patients who all rescheduled so that I could be here today.
Thank you, Dr. Lincoln.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dr. Flynn, and I'm from Lewiston, Minnesota, and Senator Ropes knows me quite well, and I believe Senator Lynch knows me quite well as well. And I have to make a confession. Earlier today, testimony from Michael Scandrett said that the dentists in my area are getting older, and that is indeed true. I'm responsible for that. It's my birthday today, and I'm the one that caused that to go to 59, unfortunately. I think what you need to know today, though, and what I bring to the table is I am that private practicing dentist that was said earlier doesn't exist. I treat over 1,000 Minnesota healthcare and underprivileged people a year with over 2,500 patient visits a year. Now, to quantify that, I see 2 to 3 of these patients every hour I work, which is amazing. So I'm looking, when I listen to the OHP bill and when I listen to the dental therapy bill, who's going to be out there working in the mass trenches with me? Who's going to help the people that I serve? And I have a record, well over 287 elderly patients at nursing homes. Yes, I am that dentist that never existed. I do it. But I don't do it alone. I have a wonderful team. We do it as a team. I have 2 hygienists, 4 assistants. 2 of my assistants are expanded duty restorative assistants. I am a delegator like you wouldn't believe, so I utilize anyone in my industry that can do the work for me. And what I'm looking for would be another situation where I can delegate and I do have somebody in the trenches helping me do what I do. Now, it's my opinion in reviewing the two proposals and being on the work group that I think that the dental therapy model will work the best for me. I have called other providers similar to what I do in southeastern Minnesota, and between us, we treat over 10,000 patients. I can't quantify how many visits that is, but we are a significant force in southeastern Minnesota. Overwhelmingly, the response came back that a dental therapist would fit our team better at this time. So that's why I'm promoting the dental therapy program. I also wanted to point out some concerns that I have with the OHP and the proposal on the table. Being a member of that committee, the proposal before you does not follow the recommendations of the work group. There's a multiple of changes. Changes exactly into the area I'm talking about, treating people of need, underprivileged people. We have almost 700,000 people on Minnesota health care today. The current OHP proposal at 275% of poverty increases the patient scope to include over 2 million people. We're getting away from our destination. We're getting away from our old motive, I think. If we have a target of people, which we heard all afternoon, that isn't being served, why do we want to expand that beyond the people that I'm trying to treat? Minnesota Healthcare, and I do volunteer and treat people underinsured, uninsured, and I'll use Senator Ropes for testimony. Mm-hmm. She knows that. We're out there working, and we're working very hard. So my message here isn't quite as academic as I've heard all morning. Just remember, I am here for those people. It's not about me. It's not about the hygienist, like you said in earlier testimony. It is about the people. And I have that experience, and I'm putting forth the recommendation that I think will give me the best ability at this time for the best dental approach and what exists, so we'll see more people more quickly and do a better job.
Thank you, Dr. Flynn. Senator Brettner-Sullivan, you want to keep going down the list?
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, we'll wrap up our testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair.
You wanted to see if you had any more comments, and we're opening up for discussion, debate, whatever now. Senator.
Well, Mr. Chair, if there's no further discussion, then I can move. Sure.
Senator Hand.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just a couple of questions. One maybe is a little more procedural. You had some colloquy with Senator Coring about where the bills are, and it is a little bit of a concern to me that we have two bills, but you have said that you would only want to have one go forward, and I want to be respectful of the committee and the wishes of the chair, but I think the committee itself may have a desire to vote on both bills, and I'm not sure if you're saying you absolutely would not permit that, but I have been impressed by the testimony, and I think there are universal concerns expressed about we need to do something to try to address the shortage of dental health care professionals. And it seems that both bills have some alternative approaches to that, and it seems to me that it would be a good thing to keep that discussion open. I think, as Senator Berglund pointed out and others, that there may be some funding issues if we go the one route. There may be some with the other. I'm not sure. But it seems to me that we should at least keep these ideas alive. And if you're saying that you do not want to have two bills leave the committee, then I'm wondering why we wouldn't want to amend them to put them both in one bill.
Senator Hand, you have the right to do that.
Well, I'm just wondering to see if that would
I said the committee can do what it wants. They can offer amendments to.
Well, then, Mr. Chairman, I'll move that we take the language of Senate File 641 and amend it to the Senate File 1106.
Senator,
and I guess I would want to just check with Senator Prettner-Soland. It's her bill, and I don't necessarily want to move something that she would be in violent opposition to, so maybe she'd want to weigh in on that motion.
No, Mr. Chair, I have no objection to them being amended together.
So Senator Hand moves, we merge the two. Senate Council, do you have something you can help us with?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lynch.
If I may, while the amendment is being passed out, I'm just going to offer at this point just a comment. And I think it would be this. The issue of access has clearly been articulated today, virtually from, I think I heard each testifier mention access somewhere along the way. The members sitting in this division are keenly aware of the budget challenges that we are facing. And I also think that the members of the division are aware of the opportunity that we have to lead in this effort. Frankly, I think we have an obligation to serve in this area. I think it's worth noting again that of the two proposals that we heard about today, one of them is very clearly, by their own admission, ready to move forward in these challenging budget times, and one of them is not.
This is Senator. Senate Council, this amendment would merge the Senate File 641 language into 1106, so both programs would be existing. Okay. Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree with you, Senator Lynch, but I really believe that that is a decision that should be made at the Finance Committee level, and I think the Higher Education Division should look at the situation and give us their opinion on that. So I feel uncomfortable at this time saying one approach should move forward and the other one should not.
So, Senator Johnson on the motion.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I actually let Senator Berglund express my concerns and also the fact that we can't rule out the accreditation of the University of Minnesota. We need to help that to move forward. Also,
and this will allow both bills to the language of both programs to be there. Is there more further discussion on this motion? I wanted to make one question for perhaps both of the authors. Both of these bills talk about I think they're both the same percentage. Both have to require the oral health practitioners or the dental therapists to work at least half their time in underserved communities. I know in lots of the medical professions, while there was once big dispute between different levels of practice, I saw a letter to the editor recently from a doctor defending physician assistants being the primary care providers in emergency rooms. And he was saying, I think they actually do a better job than I would as a physician there. And I kind of wondering, because when we hear how many hours of training in certain types of work the people in these professions would be, why are we limiting it to just low-income people? And I'll ask either both authors why the restriction there.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I think that's a great question, and I think it was one that was asked along the way. And quite honestly, I believe that was a compromise that was made along the way. And I will tell you, regardless of how this ultimately ends up, I believe that there will be a day in Minnesota, and in fact in this country, that mid-level dental practitioners will be as commonplace as physician assistants are today in many different practice settings.
I kind of have the feeling that will happen in a few years. Senator Pretner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, my understanding is the greatest need was in areas that are underserved, low income, and that the purpose for the bills was to expand access so that we would have coverage for those areas. And I believe that what these bills do is they constitute that commitment to serving that underserved area, and that's what the bill is directed at.
Further discussion on the hand motion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Got a bigger bill all of a sudden. Is there further discussion on the bill as amended. Senator Lynch moves that Senate File 1106 as amended be recommended pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Berglund.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Lynch, just a word of advice. I would advise you to go to the Higher Education Division before you come to the Health and Human Services Budget Division.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, I always appreciate your counsel and advice. And if I could just make a final parting comment, and that is I want to once again thank those who came to Minnesota today to help us work through this really important issue. And I also want to publicly thank the members of the work group who worked long hours during the summer and during the interim and into the fall so that we could have this before us today. And members, in your packet, additionally, there is a long and growing, continually growing list of interest groups and stakeholders and organizations out there that are very much watching the work that's happening in here and committed to this work. So members and Mr. Chair, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. On Senator Lynch's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails unanimously.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Oh, really? That this meeting's adjourned.